طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and continued in his memory by a group of his colleagues. This is John Roberts. This morning, the entire program will consist of an interview with Max Blumenthal, author of an incredibly important book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. I say incredibly important because it is a meticulously documented portrait of Israel's apartheid society, rife with patterns of discrimination and segregation that to a large degree parallels the pattern of the old Jim Crow South that we so deplore in our country today, yet not only tolerate, but support in Israel. The major reason that the United States supports the Israeli apartheid society is because the public is largely uninformed that it exists to the degree that it does. Max Blumenthal exposes this sordid picture. As should be expected, Max Blumenthal has not been invited onto The Daily Show or The Colbert Report or NPR or CNN or The Rachel Maddow Show to discuss his book because of the power of the Israeli lobby and the cowardice of the corporate media. Better to keep the American public ignorant of the Israeli apartheid society than to expose it. To the degree that we can give Max Blumenthal exposure, we will do so on This Week in Palestine. Here is Max Blumenthal, interviewed by Sonali Kolhatkar on her radio show, Uprising.
Welcome to Uprising, Max Blumenthal.
Great to be on with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the topic of this new book of yours, totally different from, in some respects, from your earlier book, Republican Gomorrah, which we'd had you on about before. I want to start with asking you about how you got started on this journey, both in terms of researching the book, why you picked this topic, and even just the beginning of your journey through Ben-Gurion Airport, which you call a microcosm of the modern Jewish state. First of all, why Israeli society? Why look at the rise of the right wing in Israel as a topic for a book?
Well, my first book looked at the domination of the Republican Party, a previously big tent party with a liberal wing by an extremist radical right wing faction, by the Christian right and by what is now the Tea Party, and how it shattered the Republican Party. But this is a movement that's been rejected by a majority of Americans, and that it's exerted control through disproportionate activism and influence. In Israel, you have an extremist movement, and this really captivated me, which has risen thanks to the essential logic of the state, which is ethnocracy, that privileges one ethnic group over the indigenous Palestinians. And so the right wing, which has begun to really assert permanent dominance, and my book paints a portrait of this pivotal moment when the right takes control and really subsumes Israeli politics and culture and all the key institutions. It's as if the United States were officially a white Christian nation under the control of the radical right. That's Israel right now. And the crisis that Israeli society faces is not because of extremist machinations. It's because of the essential logic of the state. And so what I sought to do in this book is paint a portrait of this society at what seems to be a terminal phase, when many Israelis are warning of fascistization of their society, liberal Israelis, and others are advancing one anti-democratic law after another in the Knesset, stripping away whatever veneer of democracy had previously existed. And as for why I wrote it, how I became interested in this, It does have, there is a personal dimension. I mean, I'm a Jewish American. I grew up in Washington, D.C. Went to Hebrew school. I went to private school with, a large Jewish population. And I went on the free Birthright Israel trip, which is, a free trip to Israel for young Jews, 18 to 25. So when you're Jewish in the U.S. and you're middle class, upper middle class, and you grow up in an urban or suburban environment, Zionism calls on you. Well, no matter what you do, I mean, over 300,000 Jewish kids have been on the Birthright Israel trip. And it calls on you no matter where you are or what you do. And it called on me. And so I wanted to engage with this idea and its role in Jewish life, but in a more journalistic and realistic, unsentimental, unnostalgic way than others had before. And so what I wanted to do is just show how it's being played out in historic Palestine, what it's doing to Palestinians at this stage, and what it's doing to Jewish Israelis, this philosophy, because the seeds of curiosity and doubt were planted in my mind at a very young age.
Now, you were able to actually take advantage of the fact that you're Jewish to gain entrance into Jewish society, into Israeli society, but that in and of itself was a great, I think, learning moment for you to see how the structure of Israeli society is designed as an apartheid state. Can we start with Ben-Gurion Airport, which I'd mentioned earlier? So when someone lands at that airport, right away, the separation, as you talk about, begins from between Jews and Arabs and others.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as soon as you arrive at Ben-Gurion International Airport, you're classified according to your ethnicity and religion, not necessarily according to what kind of security threat you pose. So, you're given a number between 1 and 6. Six being the highest level of threat, you're immediately marked for deportation and banned for 10 years. You may be held for hours or even days. I tend to get a 1 or a 2 because I have J-positive blood. And my visa has been marked with a special pen mark, meaning I'm eligible for return. In other words, that while Palestinian refugees who are driven out in 1948 and 1967 cannot return to land that was rightfully theirs, I can return because the land was supposedly rightfully mine 3,000 or 400,000 years ago because I supposedly bear some direct lineage to Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And, I was smoking blunts on the corner with Methuselah and kicking it with Moses and Aaron. And this is really goes to the logic of the state. But, when I went through, I write about this, at one point, I was asked, this is how it goes down. I'm asked, are you Jewish? Yes. Are your parents Jewish? Yes. Are your grandparents Jewish? Yes. Did you attend Hebrew school? Yes. Which one? So on and so forth. Then I'm finally waved through, but if I want to get extra preferential treatment, I'll tell them that I have an Israeli Jewish girlfriend and that we're considering getting married because the production of Jewish babies goes to the heart of the strategic deterrence of the Jewish state because they have to establish a demographic edge over the Palestinians. And so when I've done that, I was waved through an additional security check with big smiles. So Ben-Gurion Airport, explains the essential logic of the ethnocracy of Israel, and it flows peripatetically outwards. And, I just want to add that Palestinian-American and Arab-American friends of mine who I know from the U.S., who pose no security threat, who have family in the West Bank, much more connected to the place than I am, have been deported without reason at all. One example is Nora Judah, the teacher who was banned from actually returning to her students in Ramallah. And this is based purely on their ethnicity. So this book that I wrote, Goliath, is really the product of my Jewish privilege. A Palestinian-American journalist may not have been able to do this book, even if they were more talented than I was, just because of the limitations imposed on them because of their ethnicity by the state of Israel.
And a Palestinian or Arab traveler into Ben-Gurion Airport receives a vastly different treatment. You talk about the very invasive searches. They're taken into a so-called Arab room. Even babies separated. You cite the case of a 6-month-old Arab baby separated from its parents and strip searched.
Yeah, they wanted to know what was in the diaper. Diaper bombs. But over 100 Arab Americans are deported by the state of Israel every year. Those are our, you know, fellow citizens. And your progressive senator, Barbara Boxer, here in California, has introduced a bill written by AIPAC, which will provide preferential visa treatment to Israelis entering the United States without demanding reciprocity from the state of Israel, which will consolidate Israel's discriminatory procedures at its airport and the occupied frontiers it controls. So that's anything but progressive.
Now, so you were in Israel at a time when Israel launched Operation Cast Lead in Gaza, this 3-week-long devastating war that resulted in the deaths of thousands, and that coincided with the extremism in Israel, with the consolidation in Israel of a government dominated by right-wing characters who you describe in your book. And you make the case that this is the most right-wing government that Israel has ever had. What is the connection between Operation Cast Lead and the transformation of Israeli society and government?
Yeah, I wasn't in Israel at the time that the attack was being carried out. I entered just a few months after, and it was that attack that inspired me to write the book, but it was actually the reaction of Israeli society and of Israeli politicians who were carrying out a national elections campaign that was being really animated by the carnage of Operation Cast Lead and by the cheerleading for bloodshed in Israeli society that inspired me to embark on this book project. And the book starts with Israelis picnicking on Parash Hill, which journalists nicknamed the Hill of Shame, watching the attack from a vista over the Gaza Strip. This is really the full extent of their interaction with Palestinians, was cheering on drones as they bombed Palestinian apartment complexes and homes. And a Danish filmmaker filmed an Israeli woman declaring they should wipe the whole thing off the map and bragging that she's a little bit fascist. 95% of the Israeli public supported Operation Cast Lead in its first week. And the man who looked like he would benefit the most from it was Avigdor Lieberman, who, by the way, was just exonerated of corruption charges today related to his mafia ties and is going to reemerge as a powerful force in Israeli politics. He's now the foreign minister. But his campaign at the time was based on the slogan, "No loyalty, no citizenship," promising to strip Palestinian citizens of Israel of their citizenship rights. And so Operation Cast Lead flowed directly into that. You saw total support in the first week from the Zionist left in Israel. The Labor Party leader, Ehud Barak, was the defense minister directing the attack. Tzipi Livni, who is now Israel's peace negotiator, this is her position, declared, "Our troops behaved like hooligans, which I demanded of them." This was on the campaign trail. And so, once again, Zionist left and Zionist right converged in Israeli society, and they produced the most right-wing government in history, and my book really starts there, in the Knesset, with these anti-democratic laws that are being passed to fulfill Lieberman's vision, which a mass of Jewish Israelis, especially young Jewish Israelis, demanded of him.
So you spent time in Israel, which is, of course, home to a sizable Arab population, and can you tell us about how this demand for no loyalty, no citizenship, how that bears on Arab Israelis, and how the treatment of Arab Israelis has become symbolic of Israeli democracy as a whole?
Well, when you hear Netanyahu and Israeli diplomats try to deploy their propaganda or Hasbara, I have a large, long chapter about Israeli state propaganda in this book. One of the things they always tell us is that Arab citizens of Israel have equal rights.
And that's what qualifies Israel as the Middle East's only democracy.
Yeah. The reality is completely different. I mean, there are two types of citizenship. In fact, the Supreme Court of Israel just ruled that there is no such thing as Israeli citizenship, that citizenship has to be based on ethnicity, either Jewish or Arab, which is the basis of apartheid. And in my book, I detail the laws that are being passed to limit the speech and democratic rights of Palestinians in the last two Knessets, like the Nakba law, which was originally designed to criminalize anyone who observed their dispossession in 1948 on Israel's so-called Independence Day. It's been passed in a diluted form so they can be fined by the government. The government can withhold money to their NGOs. There are laws like the BDS law, which was originally going to criminalize any Israeli citizen who called for boycotts on settlement goods. Now any settler, and it's been passed in diluted form, and any settler who decides that someone has hurt their business through their speech, they can sue them for a lot of money in Israeli civil courts. The Acceptance to Communities Act was passed, and it allows communities of under 500 to discriminate on the basis of race and religion, which was designed to overturn a Supreme Court decision allowing a single Arab family to move into a Jews-only town. That's happened. In the Negev, and you know, I paint a portrait of Haifa and the Palestinian society in Haifa in my book, especially the young Palestinian elites who are really at the top of the totem pole of their society, and how they're increasingly being interrogated by the Shin Bet, Israel's General Security Service, and even arrested on trumped-up charges. Even people I interviewed, Palestinians I interviewed who work in Israel's tech sector, its startup economy, told me they've been interrogated, and they don't know why, because they're not political. But if you go south to the Negev Desert and you see the situation of the Bedouins, who are Arab citizens of Israel who often serve in the Israeli army, it's even worse, and it may even be worse than parts of the West Bank. There are 80,000 Bedouin citizens of Israel who live in unrecognized villages. That means that they're not allowed to hook up to the state electricity supply, have medical clinics, get any public services in their villages because the state refuses to recognize them. And the state refuses to recognize them because they're not Jews and they're seen as a demographic threat. And I write about watching one of their villages be demolished, which has been demolished 51 times since I witnessed it, Al-Araqib. But now the state of Israel has a plan, a clear plan that's out in the open called the Praver Plan, P-R-A-W-E-R, named after Netanyahu's policy planning advisor, Ehud Praver. Ehud Praver, which will remove 40,000 indigenous Bedouin citizens of Israel from their homes, require the demolition of their villages and force them onto Indian reservation-style communities like Rahat, which the state of Israel has built to concentrate them. The rhetoric of concentration is featured on the website of the Or movement, which will administer these towns. It's actually a settler group which will administer these Bedouin towns, and they say, we've built them to concentrate the Bedouin population. Very disturbing language. This will be the largest process of ethnic cleansing since 1948. We haven't really heard about it in our media, and of course the Israeli government doesn't want us to know about it because it contradicts their claims of being this vibrant democracy.
And so do you then conclude that Israeli society or government is in general trying to create a situation that makes life for Arab Israelis so untenable that they hope they'll just go away?
Absolutely. I mean, it's trying to finish what it started in 1948. And that's rhetoric you hear from Lieberman and a lot of his lieutenants, is finish 48. Because the Palestinians were left. There are still a few thousand left, and others tried to return. And now there are also 60,000 non-Jewish Africans inside Israel. They're a demographic threat. Their goal is an ethnically pure state.
So we talked about Zippy Livni. We talked about Avigdor Lieberman. Let's talk about Benjamin Netanyahu, who hopes to be crowned wants to be known as King Bibi. He is someone who has emerged, particularly on the issue of Iran, as being very, very hawkish. Certainly, even on the international scale, he has seen that way. The recent near war with Syria showed that. But how is he seen inside Israeli society? Does he fit neatly within the spectrum of right-wing leaders?
Yeah, that's a great question, because Netanyahu has traditionally been seen by us as a real right winger, kind of a neoconservative. He has an American pedigree. He grew up in suburban Philadelphia, went to MIT, worked in Boston Consulting with Mitt Romney. His biggest donor, Sheldon Adelson, is Mitt Romney's biggest donor. But Netanyahu increasingly occupies the hollow center of Israeli politics. You know, in 1989, Netanyahu went to Bar-Ilan University, which is the academic base of the religious nationalist movement. And he was a young minister in the government of Yitzhak Shamir. And he actually attacked Shamir, this right-winger who was a member of the right-wing underground in 1948, for being too soft on the Palestinians. And he said that Tiananmen Square just happened. And what we should have done during Tiananmen Square was, when the whole world was distracted, carried out mass expulsions in the territories. But then Netanyahu comes into office. He negotiates under pressure from Clinton. Of course, he reneged on the negotiation. And then again in 2009, he returns to Bar-Ilan as soon as he gets back in office and promises to implement a two-state solution, or at least engage in peace talks. But he no longer even has to do that. With the Iran business, the Obama administration has sacrificed the West Bank to Netanyahu to mollify him on Iran so it can begin this rapprochement with the new Iranian government. So it's allowing him a free hand to build settlements. And he returned to Bar-Ilan University recently and blamed Palestinian anti-Semitism for Palestinian resistance to what Israel's doing in the West Bank. He linked them to the Nazi Germany, blamed them for the Final Solution, and accused Palestinian leadership of the slaughter of 4,000 Jewish children in a Nazi-controlled territory in Europe, which is totally false and may seem bizarre. But what he's doing is he's expressing his lack of interest in a two-state solution anymore, and exposing the lack of U.S. pressure. And he's catering to the young right-wingers in his party, who are the future of Likud and the future of Israeli politics, because there's really nothing to come after Likud at this point. These are people like Tzipi Hotaveli, who your listeners probably haven't heard of. She's the Sarah Palin of Israel. She's 32. She's pretty intelligent. She speaks probably better English than Sarah Palin. And she favors annexing most of the West Bank than requiring Palestinians who live in the area Israel's annexed to take loyalty oaths to the state of Israel or basically be transferred. She held hearings in the last Knesset on the dangers of miscegenation or Arab-Jewish dating, and had members of Israel's burgeoning anti-miscegenation movement testify. She's a rising star in Likud. At age 32, she's the deputy transportation minister. And you look at minister after minister who are in the same position Netanyahu was in 1989, and none of them have any interest in peace talks or any of these pretensions. They want to annex the West Bank and, again, finish 48, finish the job and get it over with. Mm-hmm. And so Netanyahu finds himself in the center holding them off.
Max Blumenthal is my guest. We're discussing his new book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. You talked earlier about how you've got a chapter in your book about Israeli propaganda. And time after time in reading your book, you relate incidents where you have interactions with ordinary Israelis who, when they confront Palestinians or any semblance of Palestinian resistance, or for that matter, even existence, turn into fanatical people with just really bizarre reactions. One can almost imagine them foaming at the mouth. How strong is what you call the military media complex in Israel and its effects on Israeli citizens and how effectively it brainwashes them?
Yeah, I mean, you don't even have to imagine them foaming at the mouth. You can just watch videos I shot at rallies, like the rally outside the Turkish embassy after the massacre on the Mavi Marmara, the Free Gaza Flotilla in 2010. And Israeli Jews have been driven into a hysterical lather by their media. which is deeply connected to the military. I mean, many of the military correspondents are reservists in the Israeli military, since everyone has to do military service. Some of them eventually go into the Israeli army as, you know, in the spokesperson's division, or they come out of it. There's like this revolving door, which is arguably worse than our media, which had the rented generals during Iraq. And so I portrayed these thousands of Israelis outside the empty Turkish embassy, declaring that this rusty old boat filled with Turkish Muslims and like gray-haired American peaceniks was an existential threat to their existence, that Al-Qaeda was behind it, and that behind Al-Qaeda was the man with the mustache, Adolf Hitler, who's, and they were talked as though his brain had been preserved in a cryogenics lab in Paraguay, and it was emitting like magnetic beams to control these people on a flotilla who had just been massacred. Person after person told me that this is, you know, that they are trying to have a second Holocaust on us. They're trying to throw us into the sea. This fear of uncertainty and a lack of any, and the feeling that they're the victims and that they are potential, you know, that the world would like to see them perish in a genocide, is officially encouraged, not just by the media, but by Netanyahu. I mean, you heard his comments that I mentioned earlier, by the education system. I write about a preschool in Holon, in Tel Aviv, where 4-year-olds were lined up before a blackboard with a question on it. The question was, who wants to kill us? And lines pointed to Arabs, Nazis, Persians, etc., the enemies of the Jewish people. And then a line pointed to another question, what do we need? And then a final line pointed to a question, we need a state. And this kind of indoctrination continues all the way until they finish high school and enter military service. And the point is to turn them into good soldiers, to create psychological space for them to be able to participate in the somewhat unpleasant project of dominating and controlling Palestinians perpetually. So, I mean, I document this in my book through these rallies and through the key events that have occurred over the last 3 or 4 years. But it's really the product of what the Israeli political psychologist Daniel Bartal calls a kind of totalistic environment of indoctrination that only a small minority of Jewish Israelis are able to resist and counteract. Mm.
So you brought up the Mavi Marmara, and you describe in your book in great detail the massacre, the execution-style killings of some of the activists on board, 9 in total. What was the fallout for Arab Israelis, particularly given that one of the people on board was an Arab member of the Knesset, Hanan Zoabi, whom you interviewed?
Yeah.
She seems like an incredible woman, and instead of her being, you know, somebody who could demand an investigation, she herself was attacked and kicked out of parliament.
Yeah, Hanin Zoabi is a very impressive woman and an impressive, really unique leader of Palestinian-Israeli society. She's a protege of Azmi Bishara, who started the Balad Party to campaign for Israel as a state of all its citizens. In other words, a state where everyone enjoyed equal rights. He was kicked out of Israel on trumped-up charges that he was a Hezbollah agent. And the fear, the real reason he terrorized Israel, his real terrorism, was that he was trying to introduce democracy to Israel. Democracy is Israel's greatest fear. And so Zoabi's there as his protege, and she goes on the Mavi Marmara. She was actually she played an important role because she speaks Hebrew in attempting to defuse the soldiers' murderous rampage. And then she returns to the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, to talk about her experience and to denounce the raid. And she's set on by member after member of Knesset. They attempt to attack her. They're repelled by Knesset guards, and she's basically driven out of the room. This really heightened the attack, accelerated the attack on Palestinian society inside Israel, the Palestinian citizens of Israel, and efforts were underway to ban her. These efforts were successful. The Central Elections Committee of Israel has successfully banned Hanin Zoabi in 2009 and 2012 from running for elections. But these efforts were overturned by the Israeli Supreme Court because they're just based on kind of the tyranny of the majority. And now there are efforts to strip the Israeli Supreme Court of its power. powers and to allow the Knesset, which attacked Hanin Zoabi, to veto Supreme Court decisions. And it's only a matter of time before Arab legislators like her will be officially banned. And I write about other efforts to jail her for her speech. She just lost an election to be mayor of Nazareth, so she's now back in the Knesset. And, you know, we can expect more of this.
Now, you earlier talked about the drive toward an ethnically pure state. We saw a little bit of news coverage in the United States of some of the attacks against African refugees in Israel, and you write about it in your book with scenes of rallies by Israeli right-wing youth shouting Sudanese to Sudan, for example. Tell us a little bit about this very insidious aspect of Israeli society.
Well, Israel is the only industrialized country that has a land bridge to Africa through the Sinai Desert. So 60,000 non-Jewish African refugees have fled genocide in Darfur and repression in Eritrea and poverty for Israel, a place that many of them thought would give them sanctuary because this country claims to embody the lessons of the Holocaust. And what they found was that their nightmare continued and that they met a new Janjaweed in the form of right-wing rabble who would attack their storefronts, who staged race riots against them as they were concentrated in poor areas of South Tel Aviv and denied work permits, forced to live pretty much hand-to-mouth on donations, completely vulnerable to the predations of Israeli society and to the incitement of Israeli politicians. In 2012, according to the Israeli Committee Against Racism, racist incitement doubled among Israeli leaders, Israeli political leadership, and it had to do with the presence of non-Jewish Africans. This was the year when Miri Regev, who is a top member of the Knesset and a top figure in Netanyahu's Likud party, stood before 1,000 ralliers and declared that Africans are a cancer in the body of Israel. An opinion, by the way, that a poll showed most Jewish Israelis agree with. And it led to riots that night, the smashing of African storefronts, firebombings, attacks on Africans in the street. So Netanyahu proposed a solution. And this is really interesting because it links directly to the Palestinian situation. Both Palestinians and non-Jewish Africans have been declared a demographic threat. You know, these Africans pose no security threat to Israel. The threat is that they're going to make babies or marry Israelis. So the Israeli Knesset updated a law it passed in 1954 declaring all Palestinians who had left in 1948 to be infiltrators. To apply that to non-Jewish Africans, and under this new amendment, African refugees can be jailed for as long as 3 years without charges. Israel's built a special desert facility called Saharonim, which the Independent, the British newspaper, called the largest detention facility in the world. There are currently thousands of non-Jewish Africans sleeping in shipping containers there. The Israeli Supreme Court recently overturned this amendment. So what Netanyahu has done is proposed an alternative facility where the non-Jewish Africans can sleep until they're deported. They can go out in the day, but he wants to sequester them from Israeli cities. Now, in our country, during the 40s and 50s in the Jim Crow era, there were what was known as sundown towns. The historian James Lowen writes about this, and African Americans were basically not allowed to be in these towns after dark. What Netanyahu has proposed to do with his alternative solution is to turn Israel into the largest sundown town in the world.
Max Blumenthal, the way in which Israeli society values Israeli lives more than other lives is symbolized perhaps best in the case of the kidnapping of Gilad Shalit, Israel's national son. You write about that. Tell us a little bit about how it's so openly discussed that even when Operation Cast Lead was being fought, you write about how support for the war went down when ground troops were introduced, not because they were worried about the impact of those ground troops on Palestinians, but that they were worried about losing even one Israeli soldier. And we're talking about soldiers here who, when they die in the line of duty, you know, they're not civilians, and this is supposed to be part of their job. But Israeli soldiers are considered in a totally different way by Israeli society, more valuable than civilians.
Yeah, there's a section of my book that called Beethoven for Gaza, and I write about going to a classical music concert on the border of Gaza, the Israeli Philharmonic Orchestra and the composer Zubin Mehta staged. And the intention was to basically blast classical music into the Gaza Strip to convince them to release Gilad Shalit, because and that the superior light of Western civilization would convince these barbaric savages to put down their arms and give up this captive, who, by the way, had been in a tank on the Gaza border in a unit that had been shelling the Gaza Strip. This really highlighted the settler colonial structure of Israel and the psychology that flows from it among the Jewish Israeli public, which is unable to really withstand casualties, but is easily able to withstand the sight of mass Palestinian casualties because they are deemed as actually the real occupiers. And this is why Israel has invented the drone. The drone was invented by the State of Israel.
Really?
During the First Lebanon War. During the First Lebanon War, Israel was taking casualties by the hundreds, and it led to the first and only mass refusal movement of Israelis refusing to do army service. They were protesting by the thousands, and the government basically had to pull out the troops because of these protests. Israelis couldn't, well, most of them didn't seem to, and a lot like Americans, didn't seem to care about Arab casualties, but their own boys dying by the hundreds was really going to tear them apart. So the drone was introduced, and because it's really a win-win situation for a state like this, which can't take casualties, the drone doesn't. You don't risk any casualties. Most attacks on the Gaza Strip now from the air are carried out by drones, and this model has been exported to the United States because it has the same problem. We remember during the Iraq War, Bush was trying to conceal the photographs of American coffins returning. And most Americans support drones. In fact, according to a Washington Post poll, 75% of self-identified liberal Democrats support the use of drones. We don't see those people in Waziristan as fellow humans. They're invisible to us. And when they came to testify in our Congress recently, only 5 members of the 438 members of the House even showed up to listen to them. So we've not just exported an Israeli model of asymmetrical warfare. We've imported a Israeli psychology of how we approach the enemy population as kind of digitized dots on a screen that can only be seen by a joystick operator who controls their lives with a single button.
Let's talk about the approach that you took to this book. I'm going to ask you about the way in which you've organized your chapters, but also the interviews that you did with a lot of Israeli architects of Israeli policy today. You interviewed people who had crafted some of these laws that are designed to push out or at least make life untenable for Palestinians. How did you approach these interviews? I mean, certainly you talked about your Jewish privilege earlier, but were they willing to talk to you? Did you have to pull out of them, using any kind of stealth, the reality of what was happening?
Yeah, that's a great question. My book, in addition to being, a journalistic portrayal of Israeli society, is an ethnography of people from all different walks of life, including the members of Knesset who are behind this legislative agenda that I've been talking about in this interview. And I wanted to get to know them and understand their mentality. And often I could just call them up and ask them for an interview and say that I'm an American reporter. But a better technique I had was working with my Israeli colleague, David Sheen, who is one of the, I think, the best journalists in the world on this subject and has not gained the recognition he deserves. He was a translator for Haaretz at the time. He would translate articles from Hebrew to English. And he had a Haaretz email. So I said, use your Haaretz email and just email these people because they want publicity. One of the reasons they're passing these right-wing populist anti-Palestinian laws is to get publicity because they're so popular. And as soon as he did, one after another agreed to host us, and I just showed up as the cameraman. They didn't know who I was anyway. They don't read our media. But Sheen was the key interviewer, and then I would intervene or interject myself into the interview and start trying to understand who they were. One of the most fascinating characters I met was David Rotem, mm-hmm. who's the head of the Israeli Constitution Committee in the Knesset. It's an important committee because Israel has no constitution, so they're kind of making it up as they go along. One of the reasons they don't have a constitution is that it would require them to set national borders, and Israel has no borders as it's constantly expanding. So Rotem is really behind this legislative agenda. He's a hard worker. He works like 16 hours a day crafting these bills. He's a co-sponsor of most of them. He's a top deputy of Avigdor Lieberman, and I went to his settlement home, and you know, we did the whole interview in English. He speaks perfect English, and he told me that he was trying to prevent a second Holocaust. And I said, why do you keep talking about the Holocaust? The Nazis are dead. These are Palestinians. They didn't do the Holocaust. And he said, I have a chip on my shoulder and a tick in my brain, and it's called the Holocaust. So he's basically admitting to being somewhat pathological and traumatized, even though he himself didn't go through the Holocaust. And I told him, you know, these laws, I'll be straight up with you, they kind of remind me of the Nuremberg laws, stripping Jews of their rights, their citizenship rights in Germany. And it definitely reminds me of what Thomas Jefferson would have called the tyranny of the majority. And he looked me in the eye and he said to me, the tyranny of the majority is the essence of democracy. So through this interview, I kind of began to understand the mentality of the populists in the Knesset, who really do understand things that way, and they're very sincere about it. I appreciated their refreshing honesty, unlike many of the liberals I met in Israel, who often embrace the same agenda but behind the rhetoric of democracy and liberalism. But right-wingers have this thing called being dugri. It means, it's like, it's Arabic for straight, but in kind of Hebrew culture, it means being straightforward. It's like they tell you exactly what they think, and they're not afraid to say openly that they're a racist. You hear Israelis across all over the place now, and you'll see them in my videos, including my documentary with David Sheen, saying, I'm a racist. I'm proud to be a racist. What's wrong with being a racist? I mean, they're essentially suggesting that that is what their state is based on. Another interesting chant that you'll hear at anti-African rallies and anti-Palestinian rallies inside Israel is Medinat Yahudit. It simply means Jewish state. And when they're calling for the expulsion of non-Jews, all they say is Medinat Yahudit over and over. And what does that say about the logic of the state and their understanding of it?
Max Blumenthal, what about the way in which you wrote this book? I was really interested in the organization. First of all, I should say it flows really well, despite the fact that the chapters are very short, and you've got a number of chapters sectioned off into many, many parts, the titles of which are, well, sometimes tongue-in-cheek or sometimes just sarcastic.
Well, I'm getting attacked from Inside the Nation magazine from Eric Alterman. It's like really like the first time I've read Alterman, because normally he's so boring and sycophantic, but now so if he's writing about me, it got my attention. And he took issue with chapters like This Belongs to the White Man, which happens to refer to a quote by then Israeli Interior Minister Eli Yishai, who had said that these non-Jewish African refugees are Muslims who don't recognize that this country belongs to the white man. All of the chapters relate to the content. The concentration camp is another chapter he took issue with. But it was Reuven Rivlin, the former speaker of the Israeli Knesset, who criticized the detention camp for Africans in the desert as a concentration camp. It wasn't me. Same with the Night of Broken Glass. It was about the May 23rd, 2012 riot against Africans in Tel Aviv, in which right-wing fascistic thugs rampaged through the streets of Tel Aviv, smashing the storefronts of any African store they could find, shattering the glass, just as fascists did to Jews in Berlin and German cities. Am I comparing Israeli Jews to Nazis? I'm not making a direct comparison. Many Israelis do. I'm not doing that, and I'm not comparing the scale of dispossession of Palestinians to the genocide of Jews in Europe and Roma gypsies and gays and others. But what I am doing is I'm embracing the lessons of the Holocaust, the universalist lessons, and the real sense of never again, meaning never again to anyone. And it is a frame of reference that I have for evil that I can't erase or remove from my conscience, and it's part of how I entered the book.
Well, Eric Alterman has decided you've written the I Hate Israel handbook, but then people like Chris Hedges have come to your defense and written just stellar reviews of the book. But you're somebody who gained national prominence for your earlier book, Republican Gomorrah, which was so well received. You were lauded as, you know, one of the top young journalists in the country. I see that this book has received a very different response, even though the journalistic integrity remains the same.
Yeah, and no one has challenged any of the essential facts in the book. No one. Not one person. Alterman attempted to and wound up having to issue corrections. I was just attacked today in BuzzFeed because my father apparently emailed some of the criticisms of Alterman to other people. This is really the extent of the pushback. And then that BuzzFeed article is larded with false quotes by me that don't link to anything. So they're really, the response is pathetic, but it's very revealing about our culture and our journalistic culture. The main reason why Republican Gomorrah, my last book, was a bestseller was because I got on Terry Gross, and she just sells masses of books. Terry Gross is fresh air, but on this tour there hasn't been any fresh air. I mean,
have you been invited by her?
Her producers explicitly rejected my publicist's request to have me on to talk about this book, but she does host Israeli guests who are criticized in my book, like Amos Oz, who is accused Palestinian prisoner hunger strikers of ruining the peace process. I mean, this is the extent of like criticism of Israel that Terry Gross will host. I mean, she is, I think, a pro-Israel ideologue, and you see this across the board with people in our media who have a lot of influence and power to drive book sales. My book hasn't been reviewed in mainstream media, and you're seeing a very polarized reaction. Hedges called it one of the most fearless and bravest books ever written about Israel, and of course Alterman didn't like it. But where it is being received somewhat rationally is within Israel.
Huh.
Akiva Elder, who is the chief political correspondent for Haaretz for 35 years, has written a review effusively praising the book and saying that it reminded him of his own reality, but a reality that had faded into a kind of bas-relief because he had become so immunized and used to it. And this is the reaction that I really wanted. Even Anshel Pfeffer at Haaretz, who hates my conclusions, wrote a non-hysterical review of the book, at least concluding that it was factually accurate. By the way, Alterman has called the book technically factually accurate, but he said that facts are not truth, paraphrasing Ronald Reagan, who I'm sure is a big hero of his. The Jewish Daily Forward in English attacked the book and relied on false quotes of me that I didn't use in the book to attack it. But the Yiddish Daily Forward has written an extremely positive review of the book. A young Yiddish journalist read the book and interviewed me and said this is the reality he experienced in Israel. So it's really the reception is most negative among a certain sector of liberal Jewish Americans who can't grapple with the facts on the ground and are terrified that this central pillar of their very evanescent identity is falling away. And that's why the attacks are so malicious against me. But I encourage them to debate me every time and to engage me in online forums like Blogging Heads, and every time they refuse. No one has agreed to engage me in public about this book.
Finally, Max Blumenthal, you referred very early on in our interview to the fact that we're witnessing a terminal phase of Israeli politics. Where do you see the future of the state of Israel as it is today, politically, but also in terms of Israeli society?
I see Israeli society moving further to the right than we can even imagine, as long as the status quo encouraged by the U.S., by the Obama administration, and by future administrations continues. I see the Israeli policy moving towards annexation of the West Bank, moving apartheid out into the open to the point where it's undeniable. I see them trying to perpetuate a siege of Gaza with no end game and no solution for those people who are mostly refugees. They have no end game and no strategy for any solution. I see the idea of the peace process and a two-state solution collapsing within the American and establishment intelligentsia and among American Jews who are expressing views in recent polls about their attitudes that they don't take Netanyahu seriously as a peacemaker. Even a poll of Jewish American rabbis found that a majority didn't see Netanyahu as a serious peacemaker. Establishment rabbis. So I see the diaspora falling away from the state of Israel. I see views like mine increasingly gaining currency, which also highlights or, you know, explains some of the malicious attacks on me. And I see the future base of pro-Israel support within the far right in the United States, within the Tea Party, among Christian Zionists, among people who adopt kind of white nationalist views and identify with Jewish nationalism in Israel, among the European far right of Golden Dawn, the Jobbik Party, and Geert Wilders, and the English Defense League, and a sort of disastrous situation that in which Israel really has no good way out unless external pressure is exerted to allow for some democratic space in their society and allow for and that breaks down the separation between Israelis and Palestinians and forces Israelis to bring an Israeli de klerk to the fore who will end the system of apartheid. It can't be this. There will be no solution from within. It has to be imposed externally. And one of the only efforts I see to do that is within civil society. In city after city on my book tour, people are getting behind the BDS movement to boycott, divest from, and sanction Israeli institutions and companies involved in the occupation. And they're the ones who are going to, if there is going to be a just solution, they're the ones who are going to be responsible for it.
Give out a website where listeners can keep track of your work, watch the videos you were referring to, the documentary you made mention of.
Yeah, the best way to follow me is on Twitter at Max Blumenthal. I'm constantly there. I'm kind of addicted to it, and you'll see a lot of the attacks to me on me and the responses. But I have my own website, maxblumenthal.com, where I periodically, which I periodically update. And I don't know if this is airing today. Okay. Well, you can cut that out of the interview. I was going to promote a talk.
Right. Well, we'll post that on our website. Well, maxblumenthal.com is something we'll certainly post to our website. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck to you on the rest of your tour, and may history vindicate your work.
Thanks a lot, Sonali.
Thank you.
That was Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, as interviewed by Sonali Kolhatkar on her radio program, Uprising. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live at www.wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the WZBC archive found on the homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.